Good evening, Duncan. Welcome to the Space Show.
Thank you very much.
Now, comets figure quite prominently in the public consciousness, and, for example, each time Halley's Comet visits us, there's a great excitement. What exactly is a comet?
It's a good question. I guess Halley's Comet is the comet which we know most about, but nevertheless we are profoundly ignorant of what it's actually made of and so on. I mean, we've been observing it now for more than 2,000 years. The first record we have of it is from Babylonian tablets from 241 BC. Obviously we sent 5 spacecraft there in 1986, but even now we still don't know its density to within a factor of 3, so we're still very ignorant of how it's actually composed. But we believe that comets are predominantly made of ice with other volatile materials mixed in, various organic chemicals, methane and ammonia and so on, all locked in there as ices, and also a fair fraction of them, maybe 30-40%, maybe even more, made of what we call silicates, which just means rocky type materials. So that's our basic thumbnail sketch of what a comet is physically like.
So when it comes near the sun, it presumably gets heated, and that's what causes the tail.
That's correct. As a comet comes in towards the sun, it, obviously the solar flux is much higher, so the volatile materials will start to evaporate. In fact, when it's out beyond the distance of Saturn away from the Sun, very volatile materials like ammonia and methane will start to evaporate, giving it a coma and a very faint tail. It's only when it gets within 3 astronomical units of the Sun that the water starts to evaporate, making them much, much brighter than previously. And sure enough, it then has that cloud of water vapor around it, which is reflecting a lot of light, making them very obvious things in the sky. And also the tail is basically those same, the atoms, if you like, of the volatile materials being swept up by the solar wind outwards and away from the sun.
And how many comets are there?
Well, I think what you're actually asking is how many comets have we ever observed? How many comets are there is just something we can estimate. We believe there is something like 1 billion comets. I don't mean 1 million to 1 billion, I mean 1 million billion. That is, in scientist language, about 10 to the 15 comets out in the Oort cloud. However, the number we've actually ever observed and determined the orbits of amounts to about 900 now. And of those, a good fraction, more than 50%, were on orbits which crossed the orbit of the Earth, and so they could hit the Earth. And certainly practically all of them had orbits crossing the orbit of Jupiter.
And how are comets named?
Comets are named in a rather peculiar way, and in fact to astronomers it doesn't matter so much what the name is, we give them file numbers because things get very confusing. And in fact the way in which they're named is that when somebody discovers a comet and reports it first to the Minor Planet Center at Harvard University, it gets given the name of that astronomer, or if other astronomers or other people observing the sky discover the comet ahead of the actual announcement, then up to 3 separate names may be given to the comet. So that's the way in which they are named. So in this particular case, the object is called Periodic Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 due to the fact that it was discovered by, in fact, 2 people called Shoemaker, a husband and wife team, Jean and Carolyn Shoemaker, and their colleague David Levy. It's called periodic because it comes around the sun repetitively, and the 9 on the end is due to the fact that they had previously discovered 8 periodic comets. Now, quite apart from that, in fact, they discovered over a dozen non-periodic comets, and those are all called just Comet Shoemaker-Levy. And obviously, this gets very confusing to people when, on top of that, in fact, David Levy has discovered 8 on his own, and the Shoemakers have also discovered around about 10 on their own. So there's lots of comets either called Shoemaker-Levy or Shoemaker or Levy separately, and so it gets very confusing. And because of that, astronomers use code letters, if you like, for these things. And the comet, or the chain of comets, which is going to hit Jupiter this year in just a short while, that is, we call 1993 E. That means the 5th comet discovered in the year 1993, E being the 5th letter in the alphabet. So that's our shorthand, much less of a mouthful than Periodic Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, which is its full correct name.
And what's so special about this comet?
Well, it's the first time we've ever seen a comet be ripped apart into this sort of number of pieces. In fact, we have seen comets break up previously. A very famous one was Comet Biela in the last century. In 1842, around about then, it broke up into 3 or 4 fragments. More recently, there have been other comets break up. For instance, Comet Dutoit-Hartley broke up in 1982. But generally, you only get two or three, perhaps four fragments in one go. In this particular case, the object, the original progenitor comet, has been ripped up into a whole string of separate cometary nuclei. 21 initially, when it was discovered, although some of those have since disappeared, which may mean they've just lost all their volatile material and now they're black, rocky things, looking like asteroids, although they're too far away to be seen from the Earth. But equally well, others of those fragments have broken up into still smaller fragments, and we now see something like 25 or 26 separate lumps, or separate cometary nuclei, if you like, in that string.
So this would have broken up because it passed very close to Jupiter and got torn apart by its gravity.
That's correct. When an object flies too close by a planet, what we call the tidal force can rip apart an object if that tidal force, due to gravity, is greater than the cohesive force, or the sticking together force, of that particular object. And we believe that comets are very fragile, so it's not unexpected that this should occur. Indeed, our best idea as to how the rings of Saturn were formed is that indeed a massive comet was ripped apart, and much of that material was left in orbit around Saturn, in orbits which are very close to being circular. However, in this particular case, the material is not into near circular orbits around Jupiter. It's in fact in a very elongated orbit, which happens to be coming back to actually hit Jupiter itself in just a few weeks' time. So that is the difference, I guess, between these different phenomena.
Well, where was the comet before its discovery? Was it actually in orbit around Jupiter as it is now, or was it drawn into orbit by this passage in 1992?
It's a good question, one that we don't know the answer to. Our best guess is that, in fact, the object has been in orbit around Jupiter for something like a century. We can't tell in detail. We cannot say precisely. We do know that it broke up on July the 8th, 1992, which was 8.5 months before it was actually discovered. We can extrapolate back for that sort of distance in time. But, in fact, because of the this spreading since it broke apart, we cannot predict back further and say exactly where it was prior to that breakup event. As I say, our best guesses from various numerical simulations indicate that it might have been there for about 100 years. You could then ask, well, why wasn't it spotted before? And the answer is that it appears to have been inert, an asteroid-like object, if you like, in that it wasn't outgassing that material, perhaps because it had formed an insulating crust. But as soon as it was ripped apart, then the material within the progenitor comet was exposed to sunlight and did start to evaporate, and so it suddenly got much, much brighter than it was previously. You could then say, well, why was it 8.5 months after the breakup that it was first discovered? And the answer is that prior to that, it was just too close to Jupiter for us to be searching for it. Jupiter is a very bright object, and we know that it fogs our photographic plates and so on if we take photographs close to the planet. And that's basically the reason why it wasn't discovered until it was 3 or 4 degrees across the sky away from Jupiter. It had to move far enough away such that photographs would not be fogged by Jupiter. So we didn't, in fact, see it for the first almost 3/4 of a year after it split up. But as I say, it was discovered by the Shoemaker-Levy team in March of 1993, and we've been tracking it ever since.
How far away from Jupiter was it going before it sort of got pulled back to Jupiter again?
It's some millions of kilometres. It's quite a good distance, out to about 5 degrees in angle away from Jupiter, and then it turns around and goes back in again, as it has been now for the last almost a year. And it was in an orbit which takes 2 years to do a complete loop around Jupiter. It's unusual in that it is indeed in orbit predominantly around Jupiter. It's been very difficult in terms of making predictions because we have to take into account both the gravitational attraction of Jupiter and also the Sun. Normally we see comets in orbits around the Sun and they're just slightly perturbed by the planets, but in this case it's the other way around, that it is in orbit around Jupiter and it's being perturbed greatly by the Sun. So that actual prediction of that the impacts would certainly occur and where they would occur was actually quite a difficult task, but one which did become a certainty by December of 1993. We could say with 100% surety that these impacts were going to occur.
Obviously, to keep the comet in orbit, it's got to be a pretty big planet. Briefly, could you describe Jupiter, its main characteristics?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the Moon is in orbit around the Earth, and there are Phobos and Deimos in orbit around Mars, and Mars is even smaller than the Earth. But certainly, the probability of capturing an object into orbit around a planet does depend upon its mass. It also depends, in fact, upon its distance away from the Sun, because that affects the orbital velocities involved. But Jupiter is a very, very massive planet. It's about 1,000 times bigger than the Earth, I guess. Its radius is 71,000 kilometres. You compare that to the Earth, it's 6,400 kilometres, more or less, the radius. So the radius of Jupiter is about 11 or 12 times greater than the Earth, and if you cube that, then you find that, sure enough, it's about 1,000 times the mass of the Earth. So it is a much, much bigger planet, and it could swallow up the Earth very comfortably in the same way as it's going to swallow up these comets.
So what will happen, Duncan, when the comet fragments actually hit Jupiter?
Well, the first thing to explain to people is that when we say it's going to occur between July the 16th and the 24th, thereabouts, we don't mean that somewhere in that time there's going to be one big bang. In fact, the impacts will be continuing over the whole of that period of time, one after another. So they're going to be, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 hours apart, depending upon the actual spacing in the cometary train. Each of those impacts is going to be extremely energetic. Now, I actually believe that they're not going to be as energetic as some people have estimated. The best estimates for the sizes of the fragments are taken from the Hubble Space Telescope images, and they come up with a value of the biggest fragments being about 4 kilometers across. But I believe that is based upon a false assumption. That is, they assume that the smallest things they can see are indeed the solid lumps. I think that, in fact, they're probably seeing clouds of dust around the fragments. So I think that the impacts are going to be more like a maximum size of the fragments, 0.5 to 1 kilometer. And when one plugs in the assumed density, and we're only guessing at the density of the objects in order to get their mass, we plug that in to calculate the energy of each explosion using the velocity of the impacts, which we do know accurately. It's about 60, 61 kilometers per second. When one calculates the energies, you're talking about million megaton explosions. Say some people have suggested they might be up to 100 million megatons, but about a million megatons is my guess at the most powerful ones. That is an awful lot of energy. In fact, it's 15,000 times the energy of the largest nuclear explosion that mankind has ever let off. And it certainly is greater than taking all the world's nuclear arsenals, putting them all together in one place and detonating them at the same time. So it really is going to be a great cataclysmic explosion. As to how that's going to affect the atmosphere of Jupiter is something we're waiting to see. There have been certain prognoses made or predictions as to the way in which Jupiter may respond to that, but again, my personal guess is it's so critically dependent upon the actual energies of the impacts that we're going to have to wait and see. I'm sure it's going to be very spectacular.
And talking of waiting and seeing, during July, Jupiter in fact will be quite high in our evening sky. Will the public be able to see these impacts?
Yes, as you say, Jupiter is, I mean, Australia is perfectly positioned to see this whole thing for a number of reasons. First of all, Jupiter, as you say, is high in the evening sky, which is nicer than it being in the morning sky, where you've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to see it. It's just a matter of staying up until 10, 11 or midnight. Secondly, of course, it's happening during our winter, only a few weeks after midwinter, which means the nights are more or less the longest they ever get to be. So you've actually got a long period in which you can see Jupiter. Thirdly, Jupiter, during the 1990s, is deep in the southern sky, which again means that we're ideally located for actually seeing what happens. However, the unfortunate thing for these particular impacts, if you count it as being unfortunate, is that they will all occur on the far side of Jupiter. So we won't be able to see them directly from the Earth, and nor will the Hubble Space Telescope be able to see the impacts, because Hubble is in orbit around the Earth, so it's close by us. That's a bit of a fizzer, you could say, except for the fact that Jupiter does spin on its axis, and so we should be able to see the impact region about 30 to 45 minutes after each of the impacts occurs. So if the atmosphere has been significantly perturbed, as some people predict, then we should be able to see that using a backyard telescope or using the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, again, I believe that it won't be quite as spectacular or energetic as some people have predicted, but if it is towards the upper end of the spectrum of the energies which have been calculated, then the prognosis is that if you have a telescope with which you can see the great red spot, then you should be able to see some change in Jupiter. Having said all of that, though, I think it's really similar to watching a cricket match, that you'd really do get the best view on the TV, and I think that again is going to be the case here, that the best pictures you're going to see, and we need to explain why you're going to see good pictures on the TV in just a minute, the best pictures you see will be from the various spacecraft relayed over the television. But nevertheless, that it shouldn't be a 100% substitute for actually going out with your telescope or your binoculars to take a look, because it really is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We've never had the chance before to see any comet or asteroid hitting a planet. To actually get the chance to see whatever it is, 25, 26 separate comets walloping into a planet over a space of a week is... I guess it's more than a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's probably a once-in-a-millennium or even longer opportunity. And it's something which people should go out and take a look at, just so they can remember when they're aged 83 that they did indeed witness this in 1994.
Well, thanks, Duncan, for joining us on the space show tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.